Football Weekly.
On today's show, sit down, Mr. FA Cup. It's time we had a chat about your future. After this weekend of wonder goals, is there life in the old tin cup yet? Or is it time to bring back the tic-tacs? Also on today's agenda, the Champions League. Will Roma decline and fall with Arsenal? Will Inter stop Sir Alex grabbing more silverware than a Cyberman's wardrobe? Elsewhere, there's Sid with a rip-roaring Madrid derby, Rafa on the Bundesliga, and from Brazil, the amazing return of the real Ronaldo. Plus, in the Footballers Never Die, they just moved to Serie A department, there's more on David Beckham and Super Pippo. All that plus posts and much, much more in Football Weekly. Hello all, and with us today in the Football Weekly pod, we have Rob Smythe of Guardian.co.uk. How are you doing, Rob?
I'm very well, James. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. So, Deutsche Zeitung's Raphael Honigstein. I'm well, we've established that. How are you, Raphael?
I'm well, how are you?
Fine, okay. And chief football writer Kevin McCarra.
Extremely well.
Right, you're on a Flavor Flav tip there, Kevin, with your outsized wristwatch today.
Well, yes, I mean, it tells me what time it is during football matches, right. and then I write down the time of the goal. See, it's very clever, isn't it?
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah.
You know what time it is in every sense. You wrote a big piece on Saturday saying, FA Cup, can it be saved? I didn't have time to read it. What was the answer? Could it be saved at the end?
I just scribbled it down. I think if you made it shorter and snappier, no replays, penalty shootouts, better broadcasting contracts so the quality of the coverage is protected rather than just selling to the highest bidder. I wasn't thinking of the satellite component so much as the terrestrial.
Well, I think, you know, both are valid.
I'm glad Rafa's here because, I mean, another thing I was talking about was making the lower division team at home in every round until it gets to Wembley. I gather they do this in Germany, but only for the first couple of rounds, that's right, isn't it, in the German Cup, the Pokal?
However, does anyone care about the German Cup? No, seriously, because nobody cares about the Cup in Italy, and nobody really cares about the Copa del Rey.
Isn't that the point? We're just catching up with the world, basically.
I just make one more point, by the way? I did see a blogger saying it's done throughout the Norwegian Cup and does lead to a lot of big teams getting knocked out. So I'm totally unaware of that. But I don't think it has to die just because it's died in other countries. It always was much more important in England than it was in other countries. And I don't see why England's cultural heritage shouldn't be different from that of, you know, France or Italy.
Right. But it's a relic of an age when there wasn't the Champions League. There weren't a lot of other things. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but is it just going the way of, you know, old rain-sodden leather footballs and brill cream?
No, because I think what makes it different is that, you know, as you say, there's a Champions League, but not everyone can win that. There's still lots of teams that have to play for something, like Portsmouth last season winning the FA Cup. That was unusual. The previous 12 years have been won by one of the top four who found space in a crowded schedule to win it. And that's why I'm suggesting that maybe we need a kind of engineered structure to it whereby small teams have a better chance than bigger teams.
So the lower place team always has the advantage.
The lower team above from a lower division has the
only outside the first two. So if it's first Bundesliga against second, there is no protection. If you're an amateur side, so effectively a third division side, you always have a home advantage. But the point is, of course, there's two points, I think. First of all, the cup is actually, compared to the rest of continental Europe, it's actually taken very seriously in Germany. And it happened when they decided to make the final a fixed game in Berlin, because before that, the final was moving all over the country and it never had the same status. Now it's actually taken very seriously. And even the big sides, even the big clubs say, we want to get to Berlin because you've got this special atmosphere, all the fans, 80,000, and it is seen as a big occasion and a worthwhile trophy. I guess the problem in England is, of course, with the protecting home advantage for the lower teams, is that they all the lower teams want nothing more than being drawn against the big side for the money.
Because they want it doesn't mean they should get it. Yeah. I mean, I think the whole point of this tournament is it's been made to generate money with replays and so on, which clubs might like, but it's damaging the long-term value of the tournament.
In your piece, I did read it in the end. it was nice. One of the things that you said was there should be no replays. You should always have a winner on the day. Whereas I agree. I mean, I think that's an interesting idea.
Again, the smaller team at home has a chance of winning in a shootout if they simply hold the visitors, you know. So, but yes, you're right. There's a financial disadvantage. I'm not suggesting that clubs would get rich this way. I think they would preserve a long-term value of the TV rights by making the tournament more interesting.
Yeah. Well, certainly in Germany, they did do away with replays in the late 80s. And perhaps it's coincidence, but certainly the stature of the cup has grown since.
So these changes are more upset. That's from the late 80s. Is it something that's been...
The replays. Amateur teams always had home protection in the cup.
Isn't the biggest problem just the imbalance? The top four don't really want to win it, and the rest of them can't win it. I know Portsmouth did last year, but as Kevin says, that was a freak. So if you resolve that problem... Because basically,
how
the top
would you
four,
resolve that?
Well, I don't know, but the top four is more the top four is more entrenched in this country than anywhere else, and I think that's the biggest problem rather than anything else.
Well, Sepp Blatter's got a way of sorting that out. We'll come back to that perhaps later on.
I think that's right. I think when people say they're bored with the FA Cup,
They're
bored because again, it's the three big teams, or you know, three out of four are in there,
and that's why it would be so nice to see Everton do well. Sorry.
Yeah.
By the way, should we also consider abolishing the League Cup because it's as a distraction?
Absolutely. I'm with you on that, Kevin. Get rid of the League Cup, and then everyone can care about the all the sentiment for League Cup. They can transfer to the FA Cup. It'd be that simple. Listen, there were some fantastic adverts interspersed among the rather humdrum stuff. There were some fantastic adverts for the FA Cup this weekend, in some astonishing goals. Two of them. In Arsenal's win over Burnley. And here we really should talk about Eduardo. About a year ago, we were wondering if he'd ever play football again.
Hmm.
And he produces one of the greatest goals, really.
Well, he's now played two games this season and scored three goals, but all two against Cardiff. But the one yesterday was fantastic. A curmudgeonly Chelsea fan was telling me actually he didn't mean it, but I'm sure he did. Oof. It came off a kind of volley off the outside of his left heel into the corner of the net. So a fantastic finish.
Astonishing goal.
It's very rare in football. You see something, you think, I have never seen anything like that before. And that goal kind of... The only thing I could think of was Cruyff's goal against Atletico Madrid when he kind of did a flying volley with the outside of his foot. But it wasn't really the same because he was close in. Eduardo was kind of 15 yards out. Stunned to get that power was extraordinary.
Right. Vela must be feeling pretty sick because until that point he'd scored a rather remarkable goal, no?
His collection of chips are amazing, aren't they? Three this season now. Sheffield United, Wigan and yesterday, and all kind of different in nature.
Mm.
So cool when he's one-on-one.
Yeah, indeed. And with Walcott coming back as well yesterday, is the stage set for a late flourish for the Gunners, or is it just the fact that they were playing Burnley?
Well, they've got a hard game coming up, haven't they, and against a certain team called Roma, who beat Chelsea 3-1. But yeah, I think if they get through that, maybe. Already this season, they've beaten Chelsea and they've beaten Manchester United. Admittedly, the goal at Chelsea was offside, the winner, but nonetheless, there you go. I sometimes felt there wasn't enough height in the midfield the way there used to be with guys like Vieira and so on. Maybe if Alex Song continues in yesterday's form, that will be addressed.
When Fabregas is fit, who do you think will partner him?
It depends what formation they play, doesn't it?
But presuming they keep to the kind of
4-2-3-1.
Oh, do you think they'll play that?
Well, they were kind of playing that yesterday. Yes, they had Song and Diaby together in front of the defence.
So do you think Fabregas could play in front of two and behind the front man?
I'd like Fabregas further forward, maybe behind the attack. If they were playing one, but then they probably want to play Eduardo there, or you know.
What I wouldn't give for a chalkboard right now, just to see all that illustrated.
If you play your cards right, James.
Chelsea go through fairly one-sided stuff against Coventry. A fantastic counter-attack goal there, I thought, Alexis. Very nice. Everton, you mentioned, Rob. You want to talk about Everton?
Well, I just think it's really nice because the one thing they haven't done, they've done really kind of made worthy progress in the league, but they haven't had much cup progress on them always. Partly because he's often rested players, other times they lost, I think, to Shrewsbury. And I just think it's nice for them to get kind of visible, something from which you can really recognise their progress. And Moyes has done so well, and I guess almost all neutrals would want them to win now, beyond Liverpool fans.
Right, well, they came back against Middlesbrough. As has been pointed out, though, it wasn't that remarkable. He just brought on his two best attackers who he'd been resting until that point. And Bob Chirankor, Sahar and Cahill sorted it out for him. Name on the cup, though. They've got Manchester United to face next, Raphael Honigstein.
No, I think it's a bit premature to put the name on the cup.
Right.
Because whoever they've got, I mean, they're obviously huge underdogs against United, and they're also going to be underdogs again for whoever's going to be in the next.
Well, unless it's Hull in the final.
Yeah, could happen.
They'll probably have to beat three of the big four to win it, which is a big ask. Portsmouth last year beat one, I think, because they'll have beaten Liverpool, United, and then unless Hull get there. But they are a very resilient team, and they're probably as well equipped as anyone, I think.
Yeah. I am biased, having tipped them to win the FA Cup. I was made to tip the FA Cup winner. How do you do that if they get drawn away to Manchester United in the next round? You know, but they're my only surviving hope of a correct prediction.
I mean, their greatest asset could be the fact that they care a lot about this cup, and the others maybe have their priorities elsewhere. Having said that, watching Manchester United on Saturday against Fulham, they do seem to be an extraordinary form. And I know we've been complaining about the fact that the title race is not the most exciting this year, but should we be recognising the fact that we are in the presence of a really special team in this United side? Robert, you've seen United sides come and go.
I personally think they were better last season. Certainly creatively. I mean, clearly the defence has moved to another level. But in terms of going forward, I think they were much better last season, and even more so the season before, for the first half of the year when Saha played up front. Essentially, they were brilliant on Saturday, but most of the games they're winning 1-0 or 2-1 without playing well. It's an incredibly impressive run, but I don't think they're playing that well.
In terms of scoring, this is the lowest scoring season in the league at this point since 2004-2005.
That's interesting.
When Mourinho was... I wrote about all this last week somewhat boringly, but the point being, that's partly by design. I mean, they don't really play with poachers or flood the penalty area. They control the game and keep the ball. It's a rather continental style. I think United had a huge weight between winning the European Cup in 99 and then, of course, in last year. In that period, they didn't even reach another final. Mm. I think gradually Alex Ferguson came around to the view he had to kind of adopt a different approach, and now he applies it to domestic football and the Champions League.
Well, there you go. We've heard about the English teams, obviously Liverpool, who weren't involved in the FA Cup but are involved in the Champions League, and in a second or two we'll be looking forward to what awaits all of them. Paolo Bandini previewing the Italians' form heading into this Champions League round, probably potentially for the last time this season that Paolo has the opportunity to do such a thing. Stick around.
Football Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
Part two, Champions League. Rio Ferdinand potentially out for Manchester United's clash with Inter. Ben Yedder apparently is going to be out for 2 weeks. We don't know if Torres is going to be fit, but the Premier League's injury crisis is nothing on that suffered by the Italians. Paolo Bandini, tell us more.
Yeah, well, it's funny because in Italy, actually, you know, obviously, most games are on a Sunday, but they make sure all the Champions League teams play on Saturday to make sure they've got the best chance of being healthy. You know, Roma and Juventus, particularly this weekend, sort of went out of their way not to start players who they thought might be playing for them in midweek as much as possible. And yet you had this absolutely disastrous weekend for the Italian sides where Juventus lost Mohamed Sissoko, Inter lost Walter Samuel and also Nicolas Bordisso.
Well, Samuel was already out. No?
Materazzi. Mm-hmm. But yes, Samuel was already out. Roma lost Cicinho all in the same afternoon, basically. And it's really left them all sort of looking at these games, which were already, you know, they were already, you know, the odds were against them in basically every one of these ties, and thinking, you know, crikey, where are we going to pull this out?
Bordisso out, that's not necessarily a bad thing, though, for Inter.
It is, well, if Rivas is the alternative.
I think you've got to look at what Inter have already got, who they were already missing. I mean, you know, Christian Kiva, who's been out for a while, Samuel's been out. Samuel apparently is, according to Gazzetta this morning, 55% likely to play.
If he doesn't, who will be...
And if he doesn't, you've got Esteban Cambiaso to play. Actually, you know, it isn't necessarily going to be a disaster issue is that you take him out of midfield as well, and you're missing that player.
You have Cordoba and Reeve. I mean, the thing is, these players are injured, didn't play in the first game when they kept a clean sheet against Manchester United.
Clean sheet in the first game against Manchester United, arguably more because of Julio Cesar than because of their defenders.
Admittedly, he took off Rivas, was at half-time, and brought on Cordoba. But they've got lots of players, especially in that area.
Kevin, what's the problem with Italian teams? What Paolo here is saying is they already had key players out.
Yeah.
They beat then they've lost other players.
I think they
might have to play either Nelson Rivas, who's absolutely shocking, or Cambiaso, who's one of their most important midfielders.
I think I'm just making the very boring point. They had these players missing in the first game and defended perfectly well for the ones they had.
Well, I think the issue is that, you know, you say they had these players missing in the first leg, but, you know, the only one who's still there is the one who Mourinho didn't see fit in to start in the first leg, which is Cordoba, which is, to be fair, more because of personal issues between the two of them, I think.
I was going to say, why after they picked Rivas instead of Cordoba?
Yeah, Cordoba's a better player than Rivas.
Well, that's Jose's fault.
But, you know, it is definitely a problem for Inter, although, you know, I think that the bigger problem is for Juventus with Sissoko, because he has been their most consistent player in that midfield this season. Your alternatives you're looking at is Christian Poulsen, who's been pretty poor a lot of the season, or Claudio Marchisio, who is more attack-minded player. He's already short in midfield because he's missing Camoranesi, he's been missing Zanetti for a while, he's missing Marchionne, he's got to play, you know, they're already talking about maybe starting Vincenzo Iaquinto as a striker on the right wing, so then can you play Marchisio as well in the centre? Isn't that going to be too attacking? You know, I think Juventus are the ones who really sort of have put themselves in a position now where it's like, especially knowing that they've not only got to win, but they've got to not concede a goal. They're really sort of in a tough spot at the moment.
It's strange because I thought they gave Chelsea a really hard game in the first match.
I have to admit, I was really disappointed by them using Sissoko for exactly that reason. I thought they were, they did give Chelsea a good game at Stamford Bridge. And yes, you know, it was always going to be difficult not to concede against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, but I felt like they were capable of doing it. And I think that, for me, this is a significant blow to their chances, as much as any significant blow to their chance of keeping a clean sheet. And if they don't keep a clean sheet, I can't see it happening.
Mm. No. Roma, as you mentioned, Cicinho is out for the season. Looking at the weekend's results, and De Rossi, of course, suspended, so it's possibly Aquilani, possibly Totti in midfield.
I mean, Roma's injury list is already sort of, you know, from here to, you know, anywhere. They've got, you know, about 7 or 8 starters missing now at the moment, so it's a bit ridiculous there.
Well, there you go. On the weekend, they did get a late winner in the Turin derby, despite resting all sorts of players, thanks to Chiellini, who then did a kind of bizarre gorilla dance up and down the sideline. So that's good for Juve from a morale point of view. Roma were very lucky to draw with Udinese. Mek says lucky to stay on the field after his handball, which is not spotted by the ref.
Yeah.
And Inter, they got their heads in gear, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, Inter, really good result for them, winning 2-0 away to Genoa. I mean, Genoa had not lost at home in 10 months. They're just generally a very good side. I mean, I don't think Inter necessarily had the best of it all through the game, but Ibrahimovic got them ahead really early doors. And then after that, you know, again, Julio Cesar played pretty well, but they basically, slugged it out with Genoa. And Balotelli was slightly fortunate with this goal, the second goal, because it's really hard to judge if it crossed the line, to be honest with you. I've watched the replays a couple of times, and I think probably I'm leaning towards it didn't cross the line, but it certainly was a marginal decision. I mean, Gasperini, the Genoa manager, admitted as much afterwards. But, a really big result, and I think a real statement as well, especially now with Juventus losing Sissoko, of, you know, we're going to hang on to this this lead we've got right now.
Well, Mourinho was certainly all over the papers saying, you'll have to wait, haters, to uncork your champagne. We're not finished yet. What about Inter's neighbours Milan, meanwhile?
Yeah, big day for David Beckham, starting behind the attack in a sort of trequartista role, as they call it in Italy. I mean, you know the Dennis Bergkamp role. But he played pretty well. But, you know, even more excitingly, I thought, was Pippo Inzaghi scoring another hat-trick. It's his 9th in Serie A at the age of 35.
My word. Yeah, and what about Beckham staying?
Beckham, of course, I think it's old news now, isn't it? But Beckham has agreed to do a timeshare agreement where he's going to stay until the end of the season, then he's going to go back to Galaxy for a couple of months, and then he will most likely come back to Milan again after that for the next season, although some people have been speculating that maybe this won't happen if Ancelotti isn't there. But I have to say I'm impressed with him, because, you know, from the sound of it, he is basically paying out of his own pocket the compensation to Galaxy, which, you know, Milan weren't willing to pay. And I mean, I'm sure he can afford it, but nevertheless, I think that does say something about what he wants to be doing right now in his career, that, you know, what is important to him is where he's playing rather than how much money he's making.
It probably cost him a lot in commercial terms too in the US. You know?
Absolutely.
Well, the fans were pretty unhappy. There was all sorts of demonstrations at the San Siro before the start of the game with Atalanta on Sunday, following the exit from the UEFA Cup and the defeat to Sampdoria. One banner comparing Milan to a circus unfavourably. Beckham's performance won them over with Inzaghi in that.
Well, it was an interesting game because basically Milan were pretty awful for a lot of it and could easily have lost, but Beckham did provide a couple of really, really nice through balls for a couple of the goals, and just, you know, generally picked out passes very well, which is what he always does. But it kind of worked for them with this sort of structure. I mean, it wasn't the fastest Milan team that there's ever been, and that's saying something, because Milan don't often send out particularly fast teams. There's a lot of old legs in it, but you know, it worked for them, and, you know, with him feeding, you know, the ultimate goal poacher in Inzaghi, it worked.
Thank you, Paolo, for that. Well, many thanks. I know you've got to beam back down, continue your fine work on guardian.co.uk, where of course you can catch up with all the latest details on all of these stories and all kinds of breaking news about football, listeners. Now, having heard about all of that, time to find out what awaits Liverpool in their clash with Real Madrid, and much, much more on the Liga as we dial up Sid.
Hello.
It's Sidlo in Spain.
Hello.
Sid, let's start with the important stuff. What's the name of your dog?
My dog?
Yeah.
It's called Estella.
Estella. It's a she?
It's a she.
Ah, that's Star, isn't it?
No, that would be Estrella with an R and two L's.
What does Estella mean then?
Stella.
What? All right. Okay. All right, then. And how is she?
She's very well, thank you.
Excellent news. A lot of posters are curious about that. In fact, Foot Vantage wants to know if Estella misses you when you go on your weekly pilgrimage to football stadiums in Spain.
If she does what, sorry?
If she misses you. Does she miss you?
She does miss me, I'm sure, yeah.
All right. Do you leave her with somebody or just in the house? Are you confident?
Well, she stays at home and then she goes bonkers when I get home.
All right. Is she on her own there, Sid?
No, she's not on her own.
So there's other people in the house with you?
She's not being mistreated. No, no, there's other people in the house to look after her.
All right, that's nice then. Good. Another exciting game with Atletico Madrid, those crazy Atleti boys. 1-1 in the derby. And they should have won it, should they not?
They should definitely have won it. They hit the post twice. Sergio Kun Agüero had three or four very, very good chances indeed. And Real Madrid really got off a little bit lightly. I mean, even their own players were admitting after the game that they'd been fortunate. So I think there's a real sense that Atletico should have done it. And of course, this brings back a little bit of the fatalism with Atletico Madrid and a little bit the cockiness from Real Madrid, because this has happened a couple of times in the last three or four years, Atletico dominating and not winning. Obviously, given the fact that they haven't won for a decade against Real Madrid, now leaves all the Madrid fans saying, ha ha ha, you'll never beat us if you absolutely, you know, murder us like you did at weekend, or not murder us, but suddenly have three or four very good chances and don't win. It means that you're never, ever going to win.
Mind you, they have too much to chuckle about, because in the meantime, Barcelona, with Iniesta back in the side, get their first win in five and extend the lead at the top of the table again.
Yeah, in a way, I mean, I'm tempted to say there's not a huge difference, because the lead has gone from 4 points to 6 points, which means, of course, in terms of the pursuit, which is what the league title's become, it's still a two-game gap if results go the right way for Real Madrid. Now, obviously, it's better now from Barcelona, because it's rather than a win and a draw to catch them, it's two wins to catch them. But Barcelona did play very, very well indeed. But I'm reluctant to talk Barcelona up too much, because although they won 2-0 and they really should have won about 15-0, they missed so many chances. Henri and Eto'o could have easily had four or five each. Despite that, they were playing against Athletic Bilbao. Now, of course, Athletic Bilbao got to the Copa del Rey final in midweek. They gave absolutely everything during the 90 minutes. Then they spent 2 days basically getting drunk. So I think they turned up at the Camp Nou a little bit half-cocked.
Oh, dear. Right. Valencia, 8 games without a win. They lost at bottom of the table, Numancia. How much trouble are they in, Sid?
Big, 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 big trouble. I could say big a few more times if you want. They are really, really in the shit. There's no doubt about it. They now, as you say, they haven't won in 8 games. Bear in mind, they now haven't won a match since they stopped being paid, the players. And I don't think that's coincidence. It really isn't. This is a club debt that's close to €500 million. It's got two stadiums, one of which isn't finished, hasn't finished being built yet, one of which they're still playing in and is crumbling around their ears. And they don't want to stay there, but they can't sell it. They've also got two training grounds, one of which they're still at and the new one that they haven't moved to yet. They've got huge financial problems. They've got David Villa is now injured for 3 or 4 weeks, but it's not really a question of will Valencia miss him for 3 weeks. The question is, will they lose him forever? And I think the answer, sadly, is yes. And last week, the administrators came in, but it's not really administrators as such, because there isn't a kind of a formal administration process. What's happened is that Bancaja, which is one of the main banks in Valencia, which is linked to the local council, they have come in because they're owed over €250 million by Valencia. And they've basically put one of their guys in charge and said, all right, we'll deal with the club. Leave it to us. We'll sort it out. And of course, sort it out means a programme of austerity, which means no more big wages, which means more players still not being paid. And it means players being sold. Valencia could genuinely go out of business.
Hmm. Quick question from one of our Facebook friends. Bale's in Tokyo, talking about a very dodgy, according to him, penalty in the Barcelona-Mallorca Spanish Cup semi-final. Well, it didn't look like a penalty in the first place. Then the keeper clearly pointed to his left, as if telling the striker where he's going to dive. The penalty is taken, the striker duly hits it in that direction, and the ball is saved. Is this within the laws of the game? Is it, Sid? Anybody?
Well, when you look back at the 2005 Champions League final in Istanbul, it's the same thing. There's no reason, I suppose the referee could take out a card for ungentlemanly behaviour, but there's no reason why you shouldn't point, there's no reason why you shouldn't say things to players. Jerzy Dudek, of course, did the jumping up and down, did the Dudek on the line, just as Grobler had done in Rome, when was it, 84. Back in 84. And Pinto, what he did in this Copa del Rey game, of course, he's Barcelona's substitute keeper, because in the Copa del Rey, most teams play their second-choice goalkeeper to give him a game. He went up to the penalty taker and basically pointed to his left and said, I'm going to dive over there. Okay, are you? All right, good. And he did dive over there. The penalty didn't exactly go that way. The penalty actually went down the middle, but as he was diving, he was able to kick it out with his foot as he was diving the other way and save the penalty. And there's certainly been no complaint in Spain about this. There's been a sense of this is clever and a little bit funny rather than anything remotely dubious. The referee didn't say anything to him. I don't really see a reason why he should be pulled up on it, except possibly the referee could say for ungentlemanly conduct.
All right. Finally, then, Sid, Real Madrid are at Anfield against Liverpool, who have a 1-0 lead and that crucial away goal. Any thoughts?
Well, the thoughts really from here is everybody in the Madrid camp is saying it's going to be all right, and it's going to be all right, because we can't possibly imagine that Liverpool will be as boring in the second leg as they were in the first. Now, Pepe said yesterday, I can't see why, you know, why they would sit back and defend like they did in the first leg. Juan de Ramos, when he was told that he was given a tactical lesson by Benitez, said, I disagree. Liverpool didn't come and play football. They just sat back and sat back and sat back all game long, and they won't do the same at Anfield. Now, I'm not really sure that they realise that actually Liverpool will try and do the same at Anfield.
Can I ask you one more question about Real Madrid? You know, Alex Ferguson said they were too slow and that's why they couldn't win the European Cup. So I think maybe he's on the money with that one, with exception perhaps of Arjen Robben. Really, if we forget about penalties, they have to score two goals at Anfield. Do you find that conceivable?
Well, it's interesting, first of all, that Alex Ferguson says they're too slow. So does Javier Mascherano. It was very interesting listening to him talk after the game in the mix zone at the Bernabeu after the first leg. And I really like footballers who just talk about football and explain things rather than just say, well, you know, at the end of the day, it's 11 against 11 and we played a good game, isn't it? And he came out and he said, we knew that Real Madrid only had two players with pace, two players who could actually get beyond us. And those two players were Arjen Robben and Gonzalo Higuain, who I think is a very good player, and perhaps people in England haven't seen enough of him. And Liverpool knew they had to tie those two players down. And doing that, Mascherano said at least, they tied everyone down. I still think it is relatively plausible that Real Madrid will get through, because I think, while you say it's two goals, Kevin, I think it's just one. Obviously, one goal, extra time and penalties.
Yeah, no, if you exclude penalties, you know.
Yeah, of course, but penalties in the Champions League does count, and it could get to that stage, although Liverpool's record, of course, is 11 penalty shootouts, 10 successes in their history in competitive games. So Real Madrid will be best not to trust that. But Madrid have shown, I think, over the last 10 games in Spain, that while they're not a great side and they don't play great football that often, they do have a variety of ways of scoring goals, even if it's a play with someone like Sergio Ramos or if it's shooting from distance with someone like Schneider. I think Juan de Ramos will try and put a little bit more pace into playing Marcelo.
Excellent stuff, Sid. My word. We look forward to hearing your reaction and that of the Spanish prensa come Thursday in the Excellent Football Weekly Extra podcast.
I'll speak to you then.
Magnificent. Have a lovely week, Sid. Enjoy yourself.
I shall try. Cheerio.
Lots of love to Estella. One or two posts to bring you if you do want to comment and get in touch. Either Facebook, like Bales in Tokyo did, or indeed on the guardian.co.uk / Football Weekly page. Mr. Gareth E. wants to know if any pod regulars have been invited onto other broadcasts, Atanta aside. He thinks Glendenning would be in a shoe-in for Fighting Talk. I've been on Fighting Talk. There you go. I won it. Yeah. There you go. Glorial Hunter wants to talk about the 6+5 rule, which I'm a bit averse to because it's quite dry, this. But he says, I can't understand why there isn't more opposition to the supposed 6+5 rule, and it's not going to make any difference to the way the Big Four dominate in England. The Balk counters, he says, I think 6+5 is a marvellous idea. At the very least, it will force a country like England to revamp its football development programme. What do they say in Germany?
Ich mag's gerne.
Excellent. My thoughts as well. Rob, 6+5, yay, nay?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Right. Kevin McCarra.
I know Sepp Blatter thinks this is okay legally, but I suspect there'll be a lot of challenges to this if he tries to impose it.
Oh, all right. The beloved aunt wants to know, what's the view of Ballack in Germany these days? There seems to be a prevailing view here, in England, I guess, that plenty of his performances for Chelsea have been phoned in or conducted from the comfort of a chaise longue. Is this view shared in Germany, or is it just the best league in the world ever condescension?
I was going to say, if you look at our chalkboard, you'll see that actually he basically passes the ball square all the time. He is a wage thief. He's been doing it all season. Contrast him with Lampard on our chalkboards on the Guardian site, and you'll see that he has been phoning in his performances.
Well, I'm going to be doing that straight after this pod. Raphael, what do they say in Germany?
It's a mixed bag, I think. There's a lot of people who look at him and think he hasn't really delivered or lived up to his potential. But there's equally a very strong camp saying that people are always getting on Ballack's back quite needlessly. I mean, there's this thing, of course, about him being a loser and losing all these finals, which does stick to him, because the one thing in Germany you're not allowed to do is lose. You can be rubbish.
He's playing like Jamie Redknapp at the moment.
Raphael, can I tell you, isn't it the case, though, that people said exactly the same things about him? Bayern, underwhelming, does better for the national team. He's very consistent. The complaints stay the same throughout his career.
I think it's a bit... The problem for him is, of course, that he had a really good second half of the season last year.
Last season, yeah.
Yeah. And he hasn't quite lived up to the potential and to the promise of that. And he's measured by these standards. And in that sense, he's been a disappointment. And I think he's also not... He's never really been the sort of player to make a really ordinary team look wonderful all of a sudden. He needs to play in a collective that works.
Excellent. Just bring us up to speed, if you would, Raphael, on the Bundesliga, where I noticed that Bayern Munich came back from one goal down and beat somebody 5-1, and they're in the middle of a big four-way tie in second place.
Yeah, you summed it up perfectly. Yeah. My paper, Süddeutsche Zeitung, called it Klinsmann's first final. And it wasn't exactly the sort of final he wanted, because the indication was, or the suggestion was, that if he were to lose the game against Hannover, by far the worst away team in the Bundesliga, he might well be out of the job. As it was, they did actually again go 1-0 down. It's the ninth time this season that Bayern have been 1-0 down. But for once, they came back. And I guess it was one of the more unconvincing 5-1 wins you're ever likely to see. But in the end, it didn't matter, because all the players came out and said, oh, we understood the importance of this game and we really played for the manager as well. So everybody was making the right noises. Also, Landon Donovan was sent back to the States. That was a good thing for everybody concerned. And almost everything is hunky-dory, because Hamburg, who were seen as the biggest rivals by Bayern only a week ago, lost. And Hertha, who still won and are 4 points clear now, are still not really taken seriously. So everybody's looking at this table and thinks, OK, Hertha actually have a 4-point gap. But then you've got four teams tied on 42. Bayern and Hoffenheim, who were tied on points before the winter break, are now tied on points and on goal difference, with the identical number of goals scored and conceded. And it's just an incredibly crazy title race this year. And people still think, despite all their terrible rotten run, Bayern are probably going to win it. Because, as you see, it just takes them putting a couple of wins together and they're right back and in again.
We should mention Andriy Voronin's hat-trick for Hertha. Yes. Very, very good.
Yeah, he scored a hat-trick, and Hertha won away against their bogey side, Cottbus. Bit of a local derby. They hadn't won there in 6 years. And they weren't that great again, but a fantastic hat-trick from Voronin kept them in it. And the talk is now, of course, can Hertha keep on to him? Because the understanding is that Liverpool have not only loaned him, but they're actually effectively subsidising his wages as well. So they're picking up part of the wage tab, and that's not going to be a sustainable scenario for the next season, of course.
Which brings us sort of onto the story of Podolski, who, of course, is heading back now to Cologne in a kind of massively subsidised deal. Was it you saying how Michael Schumacher was part of the consortium? He's chipped in. Were you telling us that story? But he's chipped in some of the money to buy Podolski back from Bayern Munich, I read. They launched a kind of public appeal because Cologne couldn't afford to bring Podolski back from Bayern Munich, even though the poor chap was homesick. And so everyone's been chipping in a couple of thousand euros. Apparently Michael Schumacher among the people doing that. And he scored against Hannover this weekend. Did he bother? We have a Phil 90 asking if he even celebrate anymore scoring for Bayern, given that he clearly wants to be elsewhere?
Yeah, he doesn't celebrate when he scores against Köln, but he doesn't celebrate. He doesn't score goals very often these days. So he did celebrate for this one. It was from a header. Bayern scored from four headers from four set pieces. So it just showed you that rather than really create much, they relied on shabby marking from Hannover. And it's been a big talking point with Podolski, because Klinsmann, who was really one of his mentors at the national team and really brought him on as a player in the run-up to 2006 and has always stood behind him, has been really, really critical of him, saying, well, he hasn't been saying explicitly, but the implication was that he's been lazy, that there's a sense of entitlement that he has. But because of Luca Toni's injury, he's been forced to play him, and for once he had a decent game.
Excellent. Well, many, many thanks for that, Raphael. I think just to finish off today, some very happy tidings from over in Brazil, where Ronaldo, you know, the other Ronaldo, big, goofy, toothy, cheery Ronaldo, the one who keeps crooking his knee, has finally made it back. Now, last week we heard that his debut was marred by a wall of reporters with TV equipment running towards him, and Ronaldo, with the agility of old, failing to avoid them, getting a black eye from a microphone. He then came on in a huge game on Sunday in the São Paulo League, the Paulista League. And, let's hear about what happened then with our Guardian man in Brazil, Tom Phillips.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning to you, Tom, on the other side of the world. Just explain the sound quality there, listeners. Right, Palmeiras Corinthians yesterday, and what happened?
Well, I think it's a case of sort of come back. Ronaldo, all is forgiven. He's all over the news this morning, and you know, the headlines are saying Ronaldo is reborn, Ronaldo's back. What happened was that he scored in 2 minutes after 2 minutes of injury time, pulling back a draw for Corinthians against Palmeiras, which is probably the equivalent of Eric Cantona coming back for Man United and scoring a goal against City in the last minute of the game.
Magnificent.
Very, very big.
He also hit the woodwork, didn't he, as well?
Yeah, with his first shot on goal, he had a right-footed shot that crashed against the corner of the crossbar on the post. And he had a cross that he had someone else who scored off one of his crosses. So it was a very good but short performance. And he nearly caused a riot after his goal and got subsequently a yellow card for the celebration.
What did he do?
Well, he went absolutely crazy with the whole of the torcida, the fans behind the goal, and he leapt over the barricade behind the goal and went over to the fence where all the fans were. And the fans proceeded to tear down the fence. And sort of half a dozen military policemen had to run over and start hitting the truncheons to calm it all down.
My
word.
It was
a very big event.
Yeah, he avoided the nasty tackles this time, did he? Yes.
I believe so.
All right. How has it been received? Everyone used to love Ronaldo, and I imagine they still do, although there has been that business with the rather unfortunate rendezvous in the motel, and also, of course, the way he left Flamengo and went to... You know, Corinthians wasn't too popular, I imagine.
No. I mean, he has been sort of frequently vilified in the Brazilian press for the late nights, and then for this particular episode with the transvestite. A couple of weeks ago, he was meant to be training with Corinthians when he came back to the hotel at 5:30 in the morning. So he's gotten a lot of stick from that, and there are all these lots of comedy shows on television where Ronaldo impersonated a deer with a cigarette dangling out of their mouth and a beer in his hand. But, you know, as Ronaldo said in an interview after yesterday's match, he said, this is what I do best and this is what I know how to do. And for Brazilians who are football crazy like the English, if you can score a goal in a moment like that, all is forgiven.
As Romario has proved for years and years and years.
Indeed.
Excellent. Well, Tom, many thanks for that. Sorry about the condition of the line and that, but perhaps when you're back in Rio sometime, we can catch up with you there. Thanks, Tom. There you go. That's it. Anything else we needed to add to that, Kevin?
I'm just glad that Ronaldo didn't take his jersey off to celebrate his goal. Kevin, a bit unsightly.
That's not very charitable, is it, Kevin? No. But he leapt over a fence. That's
impressive.
Yeah.
Small fences in Brazil.
Apparently so. Very nice. Kevin McCarra, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Rafael Honigstein, look forward to reading your Bundesliga report later on.
You never read them.
I do read them. Rob Smythe. Yes. I bet there's a chalkboard cooking away under there.
It's a chalkboard with your name on it, too.
Wow. All right, listeners. I myself will go away into seclusion to prepare a Thursday's Football Weekly Extra. So do join me for the outcome of that on either Thursday or thereafter. Many thanks to Ben and producer Pete behind the glass wall of quality control. And we'll see you again on Thursday. Bye-bye.